Hello and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast audio and video on Leadership with Scott Miller, where for 6 years and nearly 400 episodes, we have been shining the very bright Franklin Covey spotlight onto thought leaders around the world from a variety of different genres, backgrounds, passions, interests, you name it. This podcast each week is designed to make you a better leader, however you define that. Our guest today is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of the book, The Art of Clear Thinking. The tagline is a stealth fighter pilot's timeless rules for making tough decisions. His name is Hazard Lee. He is a reservist in the U.S. Air Force, was for many decades an Air Force combat pilot and instructor. This book has taken off since May. Wall Street Journal best-selling book, been translated into nearly a dozen languages, which is unheard of in the first, 6 months since publication. Exciting to translate some of his wisdom and ideas, successes and mistakes, flying multi-million dollar taxpayer-funded aircraft. Hazard, welcome to On Leadership.
Scott, thanks for having me.
In fact, at that point, what is the average price tag of one of those planes you're flying around the world?
You know, it varies, but right now estimates are about $100 million a piece. So they go everywhere from about $30 million to $300 million. So it's a lot of money. The helmet that we fly with is about $400,000 a piece. So you don't want to drop that thing going out to your jet.
Well said, my friend. Hey, rewind a couple of decades. I think it's always fascinating to hear someone's career journey, how they made it to this. I know that height and weight is a very important characteristic. You write about it in the book, right, in terms of all the gear that's on you. Talk about your career for a few minutes, and then maybe even share what are some of the requirements and specifications to become a U.S. Air Force combat pilot.
Yeah, so my journey started going to an air show when I was 5. I saw the Thunderbirds fly. This was back in the day when you could sit in the cockpit of one of these jets. You can't do that anymore, but sat in the cockpit, just felt like I was in this alien spaceship and knew that that's what I wanted to do. Now, there's not, fighter pilot Little League when you're young, so I just memorized all the facts about the planes, watched all the movies, of course, Top Gun. But it wasn't until I was in high school that I really started getting serious, went to the Air Force Academy. 4 years later, graduated from that, went to Air Force pilot training, and you start off flying propeller planes, kind of similar to P-51 Mustang back from World War II, the T-6 Texan II. Then you fly supersonic jet trainers. And if you do well enough there, you get selected to fly fighters. The first half of my career, I flew the F-16. It's a fighter built back in the 70s. It's a stripped down hot rod, no extra fat on it. It's all engine, fuel, weapons, just a little space at the top for all the meat bag. And so I flew that for the first half of my career and then moved on to the F-35, the latest supersonic stealth fighter, incredible aircraft, and was able to be an instructor there. I deployed to combat in 2016, 2017, have some unique stories from there, and then became an author.
Tell me, Hazard, there are some requirements that are non-negotiables for becoming a U.S. Air Force combat pilot. Just kind of remind us of how few make it to that level, and what are some of the specifications that may relegate an otherwise very talented person from that position just because of kind of what the dimensions and facts and maybe skill sets that are inherent in your genes may have deprived someone like me of?
Sure. There are a couple different ways to make it into becoming a fighter pilot. You can go to the Air Force Academy. That's the route that I went. You can do ROTC. You can do OTS, or you can apply to the Guard. Now, in terms of physical specifications, you do have to have good vision, but it doesn't need to be perfect anymore. So it can be correctable either through surgery, through glasses, contacts. So I meet a lot of people that say, oh, my eyes aren't good enough to fly. Well, if they're corrected to 20/20, then you likely can. In terms of height, weight, so the Air Force has started to move away from that because it's more complicated than that. You have to sit in this ejection seat that can eject you out of the aircraft with a crushing amount of G-forces. Actually, most pilots are about 2 inches shorter after ejecting. So it's a really traumatic experience doing that. But basically, it comes down to, your femur length, your spine length, things like that, as opposed to just straight height. But I would say it's anywhere from about 5'5" to 6'4" is the typical height requirements, anywhere from about 135 pounds to about 235 pounds is kind of the general framework for the size and weight of a fighter pilot.
I mean, it's a pretty broad range. This could be a four-hour podcast, right? Because much of what you know you can't share because of your security clearance and your knowledge, and so I won't try to push you anywhere near that. First of all, thank you for your service to our nation. Thank you for your service to democracy and all of the U.S. allies. I mean that not as a throwaway, as a very sincere thank you on behalf of all of our listeners. You mentioned as a throwaway that pilots are 2 inches shorter after an ejection. There's something to unpack there. Have you ever ejected in your career?
No, fortunately, knock on wood, I haven't had to eject. I've had a lot of friends who've had to eject. So as fighter pilots, one thing that surprises people is the crushing G-forces on our body. So right now we're at 1G, one time the force of gravity. If you've been in a roller coaster that's done a loop and push your head down, that's about 3 Gs. Formula One cars, some of the best engineering in the world, that's about 5 Gs that they're braking at. We're pulling almost double that, 9 Gs, nine times the force of gravity. It's this crushing force on your body. So it's over 2,000 pounds for me on my body. Each arm weighs 250 pounds. Blood is being pulled from your head into your extremities and with such force that it's actually bursting your blood vessels. And so after I get done flying, it looks like I have chicken pox on my arms. Now it's a bruise, it goes away after a few days, but it's definitely not pleasant getting those. But the real threat is you're losing blood. And so if you lose enough, you can pass out. And the entire time this is happening, your peripheral vision is shrinking. So at 9 Gs, it looks like you're looking through a toilet paper roll. And if you ever go to zero, it means that you've passed out and you're going to be incapacitated for about 30 seconds. And at the speeds we're flying, you're probably going to impact the ground in about 20. And unfortunately, we've lost about one pilot a year for the last 30 years to a G-induced loss of consciousness. So we do a lot in terms of human performance, being able to stay in good shape, being able to squeeze that blood back into our brain through a good, what we call anti-G straining maneuver.
It's kind of incomprehensible. I mean, when you say it so pragmatically, and yet seriously, these jets cannot accommodate for a pilot that blacks out and manage to either slow down or decelerate to allow a pilot to regain consciousness in the hopes of survival?
No. So if you pass out, so you're going to be incapacitated. And so you're not going to be able to understand what's going on around you. And just these aircraft, they're inherently unstable. And the speeds we're flying, you're probably going to impact the ground before you wake up. So one of the things that we do is they'll send us to a centrifuge. It's this giant room. You're at the end of this boom and it spins you around and it can replicate the G-forces found in an aircraft. And it's a really unpleasant experience because you're just in this essentially tin can that you're not controlling and they're just spinning it up to really a high RPM. And the entire time it feels like you're tumbling. So either you're tumbling forward as it's accelerating or tumbling back as it's decelerating. And they just have to make sure that you can withstand those G-forces. It's actually a pretty high pressure event when you're in pilot training, because if you fail at that first flight, and I think about 15% of people failed it when I was going through, then you get one more chance the next day. And if you fail that, then you are out of flying fighters. They'll find something else for you to do.
Hazard, your book is titled The Art of Clear Thinking, A Stealth Fighter's Pilot's Timeless Rules for Making Tough Decision Makers. As you know, this is a leadership podcast, but we go a lot of different places. People come to this podcast because they want to learn from the best of the best. And we've interviewed, you know, nearly 400 of the world's premier thought leaders, experts in their fields. Take a few minutes and walk us through what are some of the timeless rules that you have learned as a U.S. fighter pilot that you think leaders and businesses should be thinking about and might convert into their own experience or circumstance. Take that anywhere you like to go. You wrote a book about
it. Yeah, sure. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. But I think the first thing is having a framework for making decisions. So growing up, never had a framework for making decisions. And, you know, it showed. I had inconsistent decisions in my daily life. Going through pilot training, they teach you a framework for making decisions. And it's called the ACE helix, being able to assess the problem in front of you, choose the correct course of action, and then being able to execute. So being able to assess is important. If you're not able to understand the problem in front of you, you're never going to be able to consistently make good decisions. So for us, that comes down to our cross-check, being able to bring in multiple streams of information to build that mental model of the world around us. Next, being able to choose the correct course of action. So when we're flying, we have a lot of different tactics that we can execute. And so being able to choose the correct one is important. I think one thing that people don't understand about being a fighter pilot is it's a lot of studying. So first day of pilot training, they give you a 4-foot stack of papers and it only goes up from there. So you're trying to understand all the different sight pictures that you can see when you go out into combat, for instance, and so that you can choose the right tactic. And then lastly, being able to execute. So this comes down to being able to stay in the present moment, being able to focus when there's a lot of pressure on you. I say as an instructor pilot, it's one part fighter pilot, one part instructor where you're teaching the next generation how to fly, and one part therapist, because we get a lot of great pilots that come to us. Their hands are great. Their stick and rudder skills are great, but they struggle with mental toughness. And so they'll be flying along and they'll make a mistake and they'll start to slowly unravel. They'll choke. And choking is when you fail to do something that you know how to do. And the reason that happens is because you start thinking about all the implications that might come from that mistake, that you might fail the ride for these students, or they might wash out of pilot training is another example. And so being able to focus and stay in the present moment and use 100% of your cognitive bandwidth when the pressure's on you is important. So going through different techniques to help with that.
Hazard, I don't want to shortchange you. I thought it was 80, but how many combat missions did you fly on behalf of the U.S. in the Middle East?
I believe it was 82.
82. So I didn't shortchange you too much. What could you share for public knowledge about one or some of those that might be both fascinating and instructive to all of our listeners and viewers? First of all, remind everybody what a combat mission is, what goes into that, and how risky these are.
So I deployed to Afghanistan 2016, 2017, and it was during a unique time during the war. So it was the height of the drawdown. There are only about 5,000 personnel in the country. And so the United States only sent one fighter squadron, 12 F-16s. That's across all branches, the Marines, the Navy, all countries, just one fighter squadron, 12 F-16s. And I happened to be one of the pilots. First 2 months of the deployment, not a lot happened as advertised, but then something started to change. ISIS started taking hold of the country. They'd already destabilized Syria. They'd already destabilized Iraq. They were growing exponentially in Afghanistan, and there's a big fear that they'd destabilize the country. And so what went from a routine deployment went into overdrive. We were doing 24-hour operations. The special forces soldiers on the ground were doing a lot of high-risk clearing operations. And so our strength is speed. So we would go from firefight to firefight, helping out all the troops on the ground. A lot of intense missions happened. Probably the most memorable was my last mission. And so we had another squadron from Aviano, Italy, that had shown up, different types of jets. So different F-16s, different hardware, different software in them. And so my job was to give a local area orientation ride. It's what it sounds like, just to show one of their new pilots the ropes. It's supposed to be an easy mission. First thing you do when you show up to the squadron is you get an intel brief. Halfway through that brief, our operations supervisor comes in. He's out of breath. He says there's a group of Army Rangers along the Pakistani border. They've been ambushed and they need us to launch ASAP. So we run to our lockers, put on all our gear, take off, get it, fly as fast as we can towards that border. As soon as we check on station, we find there are two F-16s that are already there. They're doing low passes. They're completely out of weapons, very low on fuel. They're just doing low passes to keep the enemy's heads down. And so they peel off there at their bingo fuel, their minimum fuel to make it home. And so we start talking to the JTAC, the controller on the ground, calling in the airstrikes. Very challenging mission set, close air support. You don't want to drop weapons too far away from the enemy. Otherwise, you're not going to have the effect, and each one of those weapons you're carrying is precious. But you don't want to drop it too close to those friendly troops. Otherwise, you could kill the very people you're trying to protect. And so we ended up dropping a lot of weapons as they're slowly making their way back home. Within 10 minutes, I'm completely out of weapons. And that's a problem because we're supposed to be on station for 4 hours. And so I call back to the Combined Air Operations Center in charge of the entire region and say, we need to launch additional aircraft. They say, we don't have any extra aircraft to launch. I call back to the base that just took off from. They said, we don't have any pilots to fly any extra aircraft. I was already flying the spare maintenance. So the maintainers are one of the hardest, you know, best groups in the Air Force. They keep us in the air. They said that we might be able to take one of your jets. So our jets were being ready to fly home. You take your jets into the country and away. And so our jets were being transformed into a travel configuration. We might be able to load up weapons. You could fly home, take that jet back into the fight. And it's something that hadn't happened before. And so we tried to brainstorm other ideas. That was the one that really stuck out. So kept my wingman on station, flew home, landed, popped the canopy of the jet, ran to the other jet, started that up, took it back into the fight, started dropping more weapons. At this point, an airborne tanker had shown up, essentially a flying gas station. My wingman and I started doing what are called yo-yo ops, where all stay on station dropping weapons. They'll fly and refuel from the tanker, and we continued swapping until those Army Rangers were able to make it back to their base. And fortunately, we didn't have any killed or wounded that day.
I could spend a podcast just debriefing that. To the extent you can describe it, what kind of weapons do you have that you're dropping? What do these cost? What kind of impact do they have? What can you talk about that with you know, all respect to your protocol?
Yeah, so we were carrying a mix of GB-54s, so they're laser GPS bombs, GB-38s. This is alphabet soup. So basically, 500-pound bombs that are guided by GPS and laser, as well as 2,000-pound bombs guided by GPS. And these weapons, you want to get as much speed on them as possible. It essentially turns them into missiles because they can home in on the laser spot or the GPS coordinate that you've generated. We're also carrying a mix of what are called AGR-20s. They're laser-guided rockets. And then I also strafed three times with the gun. So the gun, even though it's a kind of an old-school weapon, it's still something that's effective. So we have a bunch of, and that's just a fraction of the weapons that we can carry. So we have a lot of different weapons for different things that kick off.
Hazard, talk a little bit about the logistics, because to your point, I think the fighter pilot, you know, gets all the attention, but as you mentioned, the maintenance crews. I mean, how does the jet you're flying get from America to Pakistan or to Afghanistan? Is it made in Europe? Is it put on an aircraft carrier for 6 months and they station them? I mean, do you fly it from the U.S. to Afghanistan? Do you have enough fuel for that?
Yeah.
What does that look
like?
Yeah,
you fly it into the war zone and you fly it out of the war zone. But first, I to the first part of your question, the maintainers, they're the hardest workers in the Air Force. They're doing the dirty, dusty jobs. They're crawling in the intake of these jets, inspecting every fan blade after each flight. It takes about a dozen hours of maintenance for every 1 hour we fly. So we could absolutely not fly with the maintainers out there. So always want to give them credit for all the work that they do. But in terms of getting the country into combat and out, you're flying it. And obviously we don't have enough gas to be able to fly that far. So we have these tankers that fly with us. And so for instance, leaving Afghanistan, we flew several hours to another base out of Afghanistan, refueled there for a few days, flew to Spain. So that was about a 10-hour flight, stayed there for a day. And then we flew about 11 hours across the Atlantic, six of us, on two tankers, so two of these airborne gas stations. And so it's a fully manual maneuver. You're staying in formation with the tanker. We actually had quite a bit of weather on the way, so you're flying in these clouds. You're flying with just about 3 feet of wingtip clearance in the clouds, in the weather for hours on end. So it actually takes a lot of focus because, you know, if you lose focus just for a second, you can crash into that tanker. And we refueled about 10 times on the way across the Atlantic. So It's a pretty big operation getting the aircraft into the area of responsibility and out of it.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question about that because I'm picturing this. You're flying, and I know you're being, you know, appropriately vague, and I won't compromise that. You flew to Spain, and then from Spain you flew back to somewhere in the U.S. with an entire squadron and a tanker that's refueling you, or several tankers. You're flying by yourself for 11 hours. You have your squadron around you. How do you eat? How do you use the restroom? How do you make, how does all that happen?
Yeah, everybody always wants to know, how do you pee in the jet? And so it's just a matter of finding a gas station and stopping. But eating, so these jets, there's, like I said, no extra fat in the F-16. There's no extra space. So I would carry some peanut butter packs with me, some water. You don't have a lot of space in there. So you just have some snacks with you. In terms of the crowd pleaser, how we pee, so we have these things called piddle packs. They're essentially bags with diaper beads in them, and so you'll pee into those bags. It turns into gel, yeah. And then you can put it into this little compartment that's in the jet. And so you'll do that multiple times as you're crossing the Atlantic. And so for those long missions, it really does wear on you, because flying an F-16, it's really harsh on the body. I've given about a dozen people rides in the back seat, usually, you know, maintainers that have done really well, or sometimes local civic leaders, and every one of them felt terrible afterwards, and most of them puke. And this is not doing extreme maneuvers. This is just going out and flying. It's just so harsh on the body. And so flying for, and these are only about an hour, hour and a half flights. That's all the fuel we carry. So for these long duration missions where we're refueling, going 10 hours, it's harsh on the body. You have to continually take care of it. But really the preparation comes from making sure you're in good shape, making sure you're hydrated before you step into that cockpit.
I think this speaks to just the discipline it takes, not just physically, but mentally. I mean, you know, ask the average person how frequently they can actually relieve their bladder sitting in a chair. I mean, you're conditioned to, you know, to perform your bodily functions in certain ways. You are trained to deal with all kinds of stresses and improvised settings, regardless of how you relieve your bladder on an 11-hour flight, let alone sitting in a, you know, a commercial aircraft and, you know, coach versus flying a fighter jet. What are some of the things that people may not know that you're trained to deal with that help you also make better decisions? Maybe go a bit deeper into the framework and some of the discipline that you've learned that keeps these $100 million jets in the air, keeps you from taking your own life. And also, at the end of the day, I mean, you're protecting our country and our partners and our allies around the world. This is, you know, it doesn't get more high stakes than this, sir.
So I think the number one skill for a fighter pilot, other than being a good pilot, is having mental toughness, being able to handle adversity. And it's something that we train from day one. So pilot training is like getting kicked in the teeth. As soon as you show up, you're being graded on how you're carrying yourself, how you're flying, how you're helping your classmates. And there's not a lot of fighter spots. When I showed up, we had, so typically only about 3% of people even make it into pilot training. Day one of pilot training, we had our wing commander in charge of the entire base come in, give us what's known as a pep talk. So he asked us to close our eyes, raise our hand if we wanted to be fighter pilots. I raised my hand. He said, open your eyes. Everybody had their hands raised. He said, two of you will fly fighters if you're lucky. The rest of you will either wash out or fly tanker and transport aircraft. There's no shame in that, but I want you to think about that while you're here. And with that, he walked off. So I thought that was some pep talk. But from day one of pilot training, you're being graded on about 60 different metrics when you flew. And what it was building was mental toughness. As soon as you showed up, you would fly, you'd get debriefed on all the things that you did wrong, and then you'd have to go back, fix it, and the next day not make the same mistake twice. And so you're building up that mental toughness. We had a couple people that were highly experienced former airline pilots that had decided to join the Air Force, and everybody thought those were the guys that were going to get those fighter spots, but they weren't building that mental toughness early on. They were breezing through pilot training. And once they got to a stage that they weren't ready, that they hadn't done before, the wheels fell off for them. So I'm a big proponent of always doing something that's pushing yourself, always doing something that you have to critique yourself on. If you ask any fighter pilot where the most learning happens, they will all say without fail, it's the debrief. And the debrief is something we focus on when we go out and we fly. Typically our training sorties are only about an hour to an hour and a half. We'll come back, we'll spend 2 to 6 hours debriefing that sortie, going through every single thing that went wrong, sometimes listening to the same radio call 10 times just to find a slightly better way of being able to say it. And so it's that debrief that allows you to stay in the present moment, because when you're flying, when you make a mistake, you don't want to be grading yourself when you're actually flying. If you have a dedicated time afterwards, and I think this is something that everybody can apply, it doesn't have to be 2 to 6 hours, 2 to 10 hours. You can just make it 15 minutes, but it needs to be hard scheduled and it needs to be done every time after whatever event you're doing, because that gives you permission in the moment to worry about it later. You can stay in that present moment. But for the debrief, a couple of best practices. One, check your ego at the door. All of us want to do well. Nobody wants to be the person that's making mistakes, but you want to be the person saying, I made a mistake and this is how I can do better, because then you're teaching everybody else around you. If there's a failed team objective, you want to say, hey, this is how I contributed to that failed objective. When everybody is doing that, you have a really high performance team. Two, not to use your rank or status as a SHIELD. Doesn't matter if you're the highest instructor pilot or the lowest wingman for us. Everybody is open for criticism. We call it a nameless, rankless debrief. As soon as that door closes, everything is about flying and how we can get better. And so number three is being able to find the mistakes you did, prioritizing them, and then finding 2 points for each of those mistakes. One is, what was the primary contributing factor? What was the biggest thing that led to that mistake? And then two, what was the root cause? Where did, as we like to say, where did the train start coming off the tracks? That first thing that didn't go as planned. If you can find those two things for every mistake, then you can fix it. You then want to rebrief it like you're going to do it the next day, only with all those fixes in place. That's how you sear it in everybody's mind so that they don't make the same mistake twice. And for us, it's about just getting 1% better each day. Growth compounds. So if you can just get a little bit better, you might be, you know, disappointed the progress you're making over a week or a month, but over a year or 3 years or 5 years, it's unbelievable how much progress you can make.
Hazard, you talked about mental toughness. For the average stay-at-home dad that's taking care of three kids that are just driving him crazy, or the mom who's a single mom and she's working and raising kids, or people that are in a relationship going through a rough patch, or an entrepreneur or a solopreneur, everyone's got something that's, you know, kind of crushing them emotionally, some cases even physically. Any lessons on mental toughness that you either might share with us new or take a deeper dive on to say, regardless of your situation or circumstance, here's a couple of things you can do to accelerate your mental toughness?
Yeah. So I think one thing, it's like going to the gym. So you have to train it every day. If you don't, you can't just expect it to show up when you need it. So every day doing something that pushes you to the limit, a little bit past the limit. And then after that, being able to debrief. So whatever challenging thing you're doing afterwards, debrief, find three things that you did well. Confidence is important. It's important for high performance to be confident and to be enthusiastic about what you're doing. And then find three things that you can work on. Find those 2 points, the primary contributing factor and the root cause, and how you're going to fix it for the next day. And it's a cycle. It's just trying to get better and better. And soon enough, that'll become an ingrained habit. Preparation is important. We say that you don't rise to the level of your expectation, you fall to the level of your preparation. And so whatever you're doing, continue to prepare. There's really no shortcut other than being able to prepare properly. When we were going to Afghanistan for close air support, we were training every waking moment so that we could be as good as we could possibly be. We say that you, as soon as you put on the helmet, lose 20 IQ points, because what looks easy on the ground gets far more difficult in the air. And what gets difficult in the air gets far more difficult in the fog and friction of war. So you have to overtrain knowing that your IQ is going to decrease. It's like probably, you know, for a lot of first time they got in front of a crowd, you know, and you started feeling those butterflies in your stomach. You started not thinking as well as you normally do. That's losing those 20 IQ points. So you need to prepare to the point where you have that buffer. And then there's some breathing exercises that we do, for instance, when we're refueling, when you're going up and tanking the first couple of times, that can be disconcerting because you're flying about 350 miles an hour. Your entire life, you've been told never to touch another aircraft, and now you're intentionally doing it, going that fast. And so we put heart rate monitors on new students, and it's about 170, 180 beats a minute, an all-out sprint, and they're just sitting in a seat. And so we'll do breathing exercises. One of the best is very basic. Probably a lot of people have heard it, but box breathing, 5 seconds in, hold 5 seconds, 5 seconds out, hold 5 seconds, continuing to do that 5 times. And it will really activate the parasympathetic nervous system, helping you to calm down. For us, that helps with the motor acuity. But two, it also helps with being able to get back into the optimal zone of cognitive performance.
Hazard, in 6 years and 400 nearly interviews, I've had the privilege of having conversations with former ambassadors, former governors, political columnists, geopolitical analysts, 4-star army generals, Navy admirals, and I wonder if you might opine on the state of the world. I feel like every year I say the world is on fire, right? I mean, this is happening and this is happening, and the alliances we see between Russia and China and them pulling in Iran and North Korea, what's going on, of course, in the Middle East, and every day wondering if Hezbollah is going to, you know, come down from the north, and what's going to happen there, and Egypt and Jordan and I mean, goodness. I mean, if you're educated, it's kind of quite daunting. I recognize that you have to be thoughtful about what you say, but as a citizen and as a member of our armed forces, how would you rate America's readiness and our role in the world and the strength of our military? Any things you'd like the listeners and taxpayers to know, recognizing we have a global audience? How would you respond to that kind of open invitation?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot going on in the world. I think the number one thing is, though, we're prepared. We're constantly training. The last job I had on active duty was the chief of training systems, where I was working with advanced technology and training methods to be able to teach fighter pilots faster and better. I think the U.S. is undergoing the biggest change since the fall of the Soviet Union for the DoD, and we are going from low-intensity conflicts like Afghanistan and Iraq into great power competition with China. And so there's a lot of changes, but with change comes opportunity. So we need to stay focused and continue to modernize our military, as well as train the people that are in it.
It gives me great confidence to think that people like you are shepherding our important tax dollars to protect our country, our rights, our freedoms, and those of our allies. I mean that as genuinely and sincerely as possible. I want to finish with a chapter from your book. It's actually chapter 4. You title it Fast Forecasting. I think it's a great concept I want you to teach, and maybe teach it to the story you share in the opening of the chapter about a mission in Afghanistan. What does fast forecasting mean, and bring it to life in a great story?
Sure. Fast forecasting is where you are quantifying your decision. So under the choose portion, assess, choose, execute. So you have multiple different choices that you can go down. And for me, this was coming back on a mission, and we're coming back in the middle of the night, and I started to see this like orange rope glowing in the sky. And at first I thought something had run, maybe sweat had run into my eyes. And so I rubbed my eyes, but I realized that it wasn't me. It was actually these essentially Gatling cannons that we have installed around the bases that are trying to shoot down mortars. So the base was coming under attack by mortar fire, and these C-Rams, as they're called, were trying to shoot down those mortars. And so I had to abort the landing, fly above the base, very low on fuel, only about 15 minutes left of fuel. And so my wingman and I are trying to go through different options. Do we try to land on the damaged runway, because one of the mortars had hit on about the middle of the main runway that was open? Or do we, for instance, try to fly to another base and potentially run out of gas? Or do we try to do something else? And so fast forecasting is assessing how good each of these decisions are. And so it's a pretty simple equation. It is being able to see how good something is, so quantifying that, times the probability of that happening, minus the risk. What is the bad times the probability of that happening? Now, you're fast forecasting it. You're essentially estimating it based on your intuition that you've built over your career. So you're quantifying it in a framework that makes it a little bit better to be able to assess the problem that's in front of you. And so for us, I had to go through, what's the probability of us being landing and hitting one of these potholes, because it's the middle of the night. And because we had just come under fire, nobody was allowed out of the control tower to inspect the runway until they were sure that the mortar fire had stopped. Or do we potentially go to this other base? So calculating the odds, or ejecting, there's about a 5% chance landing that I would be able to that it hit one of these potholes. If I hit one of these potholes in F-16, very small gear, you'd roll the jet, and there's a good chance you're not going to make it out of that. It's about a 5% chance. Our odds of ejecting out of those ejection seats and making it, it's about 95% as well. So about the same, only there's 100% chance you're going to lose a jet and lose your aircraft. So that clearly wasn't as good of a decision. So now that we had a decent baseline decision, we started thinking about different options that we could do. And so potentially we could land at one of these faraway airfields. We would flame out on the way there. Calculate the odds aren't great of surviving with that. And then lastly was, there's another tanker that happened to be in the airspace, but they're really far away. So do we risk going to refuel off that other tanker and potentially run out of fuel and have to eject? Or do we just land on that damaged runway with a 95% chance of being just fine? And so going through the odds, we were able to figure out a alternative where we could fly slowly towards that tanker, conserving our gas, that tanker could fly as fast as possible towards us, and we would get one shot at refueling. And if we weren't able to refuel, we could come back and just land and probably flame out on the runway. And so that's what we did. We tried to refuel off the tanker. We were able to do a rejoin and fortunately refuel with, you know, just minutes left, and fill up our gas tanks until they were able to repair the runway. So that fast forecasting is something everybody can use. I think especially in a leadership situation, you have a bunch of people coming to you with different options. Have them fast forecast the solution that they're coming to you with. It's not so important what the exact numbers is, but how they got there. It really tests people's thinking. It prevents groupthink. So I think it's an important skill that everybody can apply to the workplace.
I could ask 30 questions just unpacking that. I'd love to know, you know, whose decision it is to eject. Is it a team decision? Do you have other people that validate it so that you're not the one that, you know, owns a $50 million jet going into the
No, it was us. It was us. It's you.
It's you.
It's amazing that these wars are being fought, and there's so much control in somebody in their late 20s, early 30s. So you as soon as you sign out that jet, you are commander of that aircraft, and you are fully responsible for everything that happens with it.
And you mentioned that it's not 100% guarantee you can actually refuel in the air. I guess there's sometimes misses of the device that dispenses the fuel. It's not 100% likelihood. You miss it sometimes.
No, I mean, it's a mechanical aircraft, so there's a lot of failure points on it.
Yeah.
These aircraft, they've been used quite a bit over the last, I mean, tankers, KC-135, which is what we were tanking off, it's been around since the 1950s. And so some of these aircraft were built in the 60s, and people's grandparents have flown the exact same aircraft. So the refuelers, some of them are pretty old. The Air Force is going through a program to replace them with the KC-46. But yeah, some of these aircraft are old and they tend to break.
If you think this interview is riveting, you have to read the book. First of all, your book is extraordinarily well written and very frustrating, because you take the reader to this crescendo of a story and then you move into another story intentionally for a couple of pages and then you come back to it. I think you did a masterful job of writing the book. There were some stories that I did not have the intestinal fortitude to keep reading because it was so riveting. I'm a huge advocate of your book, The Art of Clear Thinking, A Stealth Fighter's Pilot's Timeless Rules for Making Tough Decisions, Hazard Lee, U.S. Air Force Combat Pilot Instructor, now best-selling author and keynoter around the world, still a reservist. I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you for your service to our nation and the world, and we wish you great success on your journey telling these stories to leaders all around the world.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here. I wrote every word in that book, so that might have been the best compliment. I really enjoy some of the authors that you've had on here, like Malcolm Gladwell. So telling those stories, weaving in some of the lessons learned, is something that I really tried to do in this book. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. Like you said, probably not the best thing to read it on an airliner, because some of those stories get pretty hairy, but yeah, thanks for having me on.
You know, what's interesting is prior to interviewing you, I was telling our producers, who are my confidants, in terms of which guests we select and which interviews we like. And I said, this book is really well written. I said, and I can't see where he had anybody actually co-write the book for him. So maybe you've got a good future as a fiction or nonfiction writer if the Air Force thing doesn't work out for you long term, my friend.
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you back here next week for a new riveting conversation on leadership.